Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on Auto Trader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. If you're someone who wants to lose weight, you've probably spent some time thinking about and experimenting with different diets. Browse the literal shelves of a bookstore or the metaphorical ones of the internet, and you can find thousands of options to choose from, each with their ardent fans and supposedly decisive rationales. But which diet really works best? And most importantly, given that 95% of people who lose weight on a diet just gain it back, what is a plan that as an average human can stick with for the long haul? My guest today is in a distinctively well-informed position to comment on this question, having personally test-driven over a dozen diets in 3 years. His name is Barry Esterbrook, and he's an investigative journalist and the author of Just Eat, One Reporter's Quest for a Weight Loss Regimen That Works. We begin our conversation with what set Barry on his quest to find the best, most sustainable diet. We then get into the fact that the ideas behind modern diets aren't new and the sometimes weird history of their predecessors. From there, we turn to Barry's experiments with contemporary diets, including what happened when he tried eating both a low-carb and low-fat diet, joining Weight Watchers, and figuring out what he can learn from the eating habits of the Greeks and French. We end our conversation with what Barry ultimately changed about his own diet to successfully drop the pounds and what he discovered as to what really works best for sustainable weight loss. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/rightdiet. Barry Esterbrook, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you got a book out called Just Eat, One Reporter's Quest for a Weight Loss Regimen That Works. And so you made yourself a guinea pig and tried all the diets that are out there because you needed to lose some weight. What kickstarted you trying all these popular weight loss programs out there?
Well, I guess you could say it was probably a kick in the rear end from my doctor, verbally speaking. He sort of, in his quiet way, read me the riot act. I had a very high cholesterol levels. I had very high blood pressure. And he said, Barry, I can't give you any more meds. You're maxed out. Your maximum amount I'm allowed to give. And about the only thing you can do if you want to get these two factors, both of which are, you know, signs that you're headed for a heart attack, if you want to get them down, you're going to have to lose weight. And it so happens that I do have a history of cardiovascular disease in the family. Most of the men in my family have eventually died from it. And I wasn't quite ready to continue that tradition. So for the first time in my life, you know, I was one of the people who, I don't diet. I'd never do that. First time in my life, I went on a diet.
And not just a diet. You went on multiple diets to try them out.
Well, right. I went on a diet. It was the fad diet du jour. It was called Whole30. And everyone I knew seemed to be on it a few years ago. And so I just went on it because, hey, that was what everyone was doing. It was a stupid thing to do because what I did was I suffered for 30 days deprivation. I proudly dropped 13 pounds and then almost instantly gained them all back. So that got me thinking, you know, I'm supposed to be an investigative journalist who covers food, you know, all aspects of food and food production. And I'd gone and done the very thing that I sort of encourage my readers not to do. I went on a diet without thinking, without understanding, just because, you know, everybody I knew seemed to be on it. I had given it no more thought than I do when I go in and pick up a bag of yellow onions at the supermarket. And here, you know, I was affecting my health. It could be damaging my health. I had no idea of why the diet worked or didn't work, who the people were who were espousing this diet, what were their qualifications, and what medically inside me was happening according to experts. So I decided that I would simply, you know, apply my journalistic training, which suggested that I go on these various diets that are out there. I ended up going on about 12 or 13 of them over a course of 3 years. And then I would interview the people who created them, if they were still around. And I would interview leading nutritionists and medical doctors and find out what was happening to me. Why was I taking risks? And ultimately, personally, I would find out is, hey, can you live this way? I mean, the best diet is no good if you can't stick to it. So it was so I embarked on this 3-year program of trying any diet that was out there to see what would happen, and then trying to understand the science behind it.
And so, as you said, there's a lot of options for people to choose from. If someone is in your shoes and they need to lose weight, they just go online, they just go to a bookstore, and they're going to find different types of diets. There's, you know, the Whole 30 that you did, there's cleanse diets, there's paleo, there's low carb, low fat. And you think this is a modern phenomenon, but you do like a historical survey and saying these different options for Americans in particular, it's been around for centuries. So like in your research, like what's the earliest known diet book that you came across in your research?
A fellow named William Banting, who was a British undertaker of all professions, is credited with really the first diet book per se. You might call it a diet booklet. It was maybe 30 pages long, and it was called A Letter on Corpulence, and it was published in the 1850s, mid-1800s. And he's generally credited with the first actual diet book. I mean, people have been writing about diets since ancient Greece, but he's sort of the father of what became this industry of diets and diet books that we live in today. He was an undertaker. He was 5 feet tall. He weighed well over 200 pounds. He'd gotten to the point where he couldn't tie his shoes. He couldn't climb stairs or descend stairs. He said he couldn't take care of all the personal niceties, whatever that is. I don't want to think about it. And so he started eating eventually, after trying everything, according to the instructions of a doctor who suggested that basically he stop eating plain carbohydrates. He ate very few carbohydrates at all. He went on a pretty much a meat diet. And within a year, he had lost 46 pounds. He could do all those things he couldn't do before. And he lived for another 20-odd years until he was in his 80s and never put a pound back on. And so he wrote this pamphlet to show others how he did that.
Yeah, he's like the father of the low-carb diet. And it was such a...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it was such a phenomenon, like it was such a thing that people called it, when they said they were going to go on a diet, they'd say, I'm Banting. Like his name became a verb.
Yeah, it did. You know, I'm Banting, I'm going on a bant, I need to bant. It actually entered the language for a period of time.
And then around the same time, a little bit later, you had the origins of the low-fat, kind of high-carb diet. It started kind of with the temperance movement in America, and the Graham kind of kickstarted this. Tell us about that.
Well, Sylvester Graham was a Presbyterian preacher originally. You know, a very stern, religious man. And he left that career to become a lecturer on all forms of temperance. And he then focused in on diet. And he basically thought that anything a normal person would enjoy, spices, sugar, fat, meat, anything the person would enjoy was sinful. And he was very concerned about men's libido. And, you know, he said such a diet increased libido, which was bad, and led to masturbation and on. And it became a quasi-religion, but it was this, it became very popular. You know, restaurants would serve Graham fare. We know him today. He survives in the grocery store as Graham crackers, although I think he'd probably be shocked about the amount of sugar in the modern Graham cracker. But, you know, he became very influential And yeah, preaching the exact opposite from, you know, Banting, who had come a few years prior.
Besides those kind of genres, you also highlight along the way, there's been all these different weird fad diets in American history. What are some of like the weirdest ones you came across?
Oh, God. There was a big craze started in the early part of this century of these two ingredient diets, I guess you'd call them. You know, for a diet where all you would eat was bananas and skim milk. You'd eat about a half a dozen bananas a day and a few glasses of skim milk. That's it. And that was, it became very popular, surprisingly. And so, you know, it inspired a host of imitators. So you could go on a diet allowing only tomatoes and hard-boiled eggs. Or if you didn't like that, how about pineapple and lamb chops? Nothing more. Or baked potatoes and buttermilk? Nothing more. And, you know, people did lose weight because if you're eating nothing but pineapples and buttermilk, there's no way you can, you know, consume enough pineapple and buttermilk to get the amount of calories you need in a day. So you'll start losing weight.
Another one that you highlight that was funny is Fletcherizing. What is Fletcherizing?
It's amazing. It was hugely popular in its day. I mean, you talk about the presidents went on it. Thomas Edison went on it. Marcel Proust went on it. All sorts of famous people went on it. The legislatures actually suggested that all children be taught. And what Fletcherizing or Fletcher suggested was that every bite be chewed rhythmically 100 times a minute until there was no flavor left in the food that you were chewing. And it was just a sloppy, you know, goop that you almost couldn't help but swallow and just reflexively. And, you know, that he had different amounts of chewing required for, say, a piece of bread, maybe 50 chews, something like an apple, several hundred. And it became really popular. I mean, there were parties held in high society where people sat around the table not talking because they were so busy chewing constantly. He thought it would save the world, save it from gluttony, end crime, you know, be a great economy because you've got all the nourishment you possibly could out of the food. He had a very peculiar fascination with excrement, claiming that when you Fletcherize, as it was called, your excrement contained no poisons, nothing offensive in the least. He himself used the toilet for that purpose about every 2 weeks. He was known to carry his own excrement around in his pocket if you doubted that it was inoffensive. Said it tasted, it was no more offensive than a biscuit, he said. And you got to remember, this guy, you know, all these famous people, all these politicians worshipped him, basically. They thought he had the answer. The thing about these weird historical diets is we need to put them in perspective, because it's something we don't have today when we say go on a keto diet, that someday, maybe, people will think it's as silly as Fletcherism or eating nothing but bananas and skim milk.
Right. Or those cleanse diets where you drink cayenne pepper and maple syrup or whatever.
I did go on one of those.
Yeah, how'd that go?
I don't. Well, let's say I don't know if you can really describe it accurately in a family friendly podcast. But I lasted about 4 days. I had extreme digestive issues, diarrhea, no energy after a few days, dizziness, and I finally quit just because I was worried that I was going to injure myself. And yeah, I lost 8 pounds in a week and instantly gained them all back.
Yeah, you probably lost a lot of just water weight and glycogen.
Yeah, that's exactly it. When you're very hungry and you're getting absolutely no carbohydrates or very limited carbohydrates in your diet, your body shifts from burning glucose, its normal fuel, a sugar, to burning glycogen, like you said, a compound that's made in the liver. And glycogen's always comes attached to a couple of molecules of water. So as you burn a molecule of glycogen, that water gets released and you excrete it. So what you're doing is just, you know, excreting that water. And then the minute you start to eat again, you go back to burning glucose, stop burning glycogen, and your liver goes into overdrive to build back up its glycogen, which means it needs to start adding water back into the whole system. So you're getting it right back.
Gotcha. All right. So I think from the top, we can just dismiss these quack stuff like Fletcherizing, cleanse diets, the two food or single food diets. I remember when I was a kid, growing up in like the 80s, 90s, like grapefruit was the thing. It's like you have to have a thing of grapefruit in the morning and something else, or rice cakes. That's not going to work. It's not sustainable. So basically you say, if you look at all the diets out there, and we're excluding all the quack stuff, there are basically three types. There's the low carb diet, sort of Bantingism. There's the low fat, kind of high carbohydrate. So we're talking about grains, whole vegetables, whole fruits. That was inspired by Graham. And then the third one is you don't even look at carbs or fat. You just look at total calories that you consume. And if you burn more than you consume, you're going to lose weight. Is that basically the three types of diets out there?
Yeah. I think you can categorize almost every diet slip it into one of those slots. The key is people keep reinventing them, rebranding them so that they sound new and exciting. If you get a good name and rebrand it enough, you know, you're going to make a lot of money.
Right.
But that seems to be the secret. The same formula, the same everything, just these three different categories. And they're still around.
Yeah. So you start off looking at the sort of low fat, kind of good carbohydrate diet. And the primary predecessor here today of Grammarism, we'll call it, is a guy named Dean Ornish. So what's his diet and what does the research say about what he recommends?
Dean Ornish is a doctor. He now lives in the San Francisco area. And he came up with a diet in the 80s that basically is strictly vegetarian for all intents and purposes. And then on top of that, it's less than 10% fat. And that includes fat from vegetable sources, olive oil, nuts, things like that. So it's a very, very low fat vegetarian diet. He has done research and others have followed that shows that if you follow that diet, you not only lose weight, but you can really improve your blood chemistry. Ornish says, although a lot of people dispute him, that you can reverse heart disease, or certainly it won't keep getting worse. He's got all of these stories about patients who, you know, couldn't walk across the street, who finally, you know, went on this program and all of a sudden could become moderately active again. And, you know, my finding is, yeah, I lost weight, but I was constantly craving a nice seared steak or a plate of eggs in the morning. I became almost obsessive about that. So that type of diet is not something that I could live with, even with the health benefits. In you know, maybe if I was, you know, a cardiac cripple or something like that, I would change. But it's just there's no real love or of food or pleasure or sensual pleasure, the whole thing that makes eating a joy to a lot of people.
Yeah, and he's very adamant. You have to be very strict with his diet. It's like Grahamism, right? You have to like stick with it religiously. You can't deviate at all.
Right. I mean, it's interesting you said that, because it is got religious. A lot of these diets have religious overtones, even though they're completely secular. You know, it's like you've joined a cult or a church or something, a church of very low fat, and you know, there are sins and things like that. It's an interesting cultural phenomenon, but you're exactly right.
So you did lose weight, but it wasn't sustainable because the food just wasn't palatable. Like you just stopped enjoying food. But the other thing you talk about too is that it was a lot of work to make the food that lined up with Ornish's diet. Like you'd spend hours, hours cooking meals.
Exactly. And prepping them and cooking them. And it would be great if you have a personal chef on your household's payroll, I suppose. But I don't happen to be in that position. So yeah, you know, I don't have an hour to prepare lunch during the week. Sorry. And that's the type of thing that following the recipes that he provides would require. To be up in the kitchen chopping, and mixing and you know, sautéing in water instead of oil. And, you know, sometimes all I want for lunch is a couple of nice slices of bread with a piece of meat in between them and eat it and be done.
All right. So, okay, Ornish's diet, you can lose weight on it, but probably not sustainable for most people. You lost some weight, but I imagine you gained it back after you stopped.
I went on these 13 diets or so. And, you know, I hate to sound like a broken record, but I was a world champion at losing 5 to 10% of my weight on a diet. Never failed. And then gained it all back. And that makes me very typical. That happens to 95% of the people who go on any diet, according to scientists. So, you know, it's the pattern, and I think we all know it, that when you go on a diet, you will lose weight. But as soon as you go off, you're back to square one, or even worse, even a little heavier.
Right. No, yeah, you typically gain a little bit more weight. Okay, so after going, you know, visiting low-fat, kind of high-carb vegetarian diet land, you went over to the Banting side, the low-carb, high-fat type of diet. So which ones did you experience? Like, so there's all sorts of different types of low-carb diet. There's Atkins, there's Paleo, there's South Beach, there's Keto. So which ones did you try out there?
I tried out Keto and South Beach. South Beach is sort of, it's a milder, friendlier, more healthful version of Atkins, who's really the founder of all these modern low-carb diets. His book, The Atkins Diet Revolution, sort of set the modern phase of these diets in motion. And all the diets that you mentioned, Keto, Paleo, South Beach, Zone, they all emerged from the original work by Atkins, which, you know, basically unlimited amounts of fat and red meat. And in the early stages, almost no carbohydrates. You could be living off nothing but T-bone steaks, three meals a day. And that'd be fine with the early Atkins. And since then, it's been modified. And the South Beach is a much more healthful, sustainable, distant cousin of the Atkins diet. But yes, you're right. It stresses avoiding simple carbohydrates, white bread, white rice, white, you know, anything pretty much other than cauliflower, I guess, but allows you to eat lean meats in pretty much unlimited quantities. So I spent a while on that. I found it much easier to follow than the ultra, ultra low fat diet. Did have some of the same issues with it. A friend of mine went on it, and she calls it the chop chop diet. Because again, you're at the cutting board doing a lot of prep. You know, what are you going to have for lunch today if you can't have bread of any sort? But it was more tolerable, I thought. However, at the end, it was the same situation. I lost some weight and gained it all back.
Yeah, again, I mean, maybe the sustainability there was the prep part was getting in the way. And I think with all these diets, so like, I think a lot of people have gone on low-carb diets and said, oh man, I've just lost, it's been the game changer.
Right.
But I think what the research says is that pretty much like even if you go on a low-fat diet, you're going to lose weight initially. Then it kind of, just like a low-carb diet, you'll lose weight initially. Then it starts slowing down. And then if you don't keep it going, then you're hosed. You're going to gain it back.
Yeah, there's actually been good scientific studies that say exactly that. They say you can lose weight on low carb, you can lose weight on high carb. People do. Same amount, pretty much, but then gain it all back. So that both diets, if you stick to them, are going to give you the same result, which pretty much for most people is you end up back where you were at the beginning.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce and a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chop sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show.
All right. So the low carb diet, a little bit more palatable because, I mean, who doesn't like to eat meat and T-bone steaks and things like that? But still, there's a lot of prep there that can get in the way of making it sustainable. So after you tried the low carb diet, so you did the low fat diet, then you just tried to go, which is, oh, I'm just going to count calories. And you did that by joining Weight Watchers, now called WW, which I think is the worst rebranding in the world. I still call it Weight Watchers. It's like Kinko's being turned into I still call it the FedEx store Kinko's. You're always going to be Kinko's. So Weight Watchers, what was your experience with Weight Watchers?
Well, Weight Watchers is first of all, it's kind of like a 12-step program for overeaters. You're given a daily quota of, they call them smart points. And really what they are to save you from figuring out the caloric value of everything. It's a simplification of, they're basically calories, or they're based on calories, I should say. So you get a certain number of smart points per day, and each food item costs a certain number of points, and you try to keep below or at your limit of points per day. And to do that, you attend weekly meetings with similarly overweight folks, and you get a little pep talk and share. And the idea is that that helps keep you motivated to stay on the program. And I was at first. I was a champion. Yeah, I went in there, and the first week, I lost 6 pounds. And I got a little star. It's sort of childish, but they give you out these little gimmicks. So I got a little star given to me to paste into a booklet that comes with your membership. And then the whole group, about 30 people, gave me a round of applause. I didn't get that the second week because I only lost a pound. And by the fourth week, I'd lost a total of 2 pounds. So I'd come back up from my victory the first week. And at that point, I resigned, figuring that at that rate of loss, it would cost me thousands of dollars to lose the weight I wanted to lose, because it does cost you about $50 a month to be a member. But I should add that for certain people, I'm glad I tried Weight Watchers, and I would actually recommend it, because for certain people, it really does work. But you've got to be one of those people who really get off on group therapy and meetings and peer support and things like that. There's some pretty good scientific work that shows that if it's for you, Weight Watchers can be effective. It ain't for me.
Right. And the other nice thing about Weight Watchers is that they don't limit you on what you can eat. As long as you stay within those points, like, you're good. So you could, like, if you wanted a Pop-Tart, like, a Pop-Tart's going to have the point count. So you can have it, but it might mean you have to cut back on what you eat at dinner that night.
Exactly. There's nothing is off limit, but the point system is really skewed to subtly steer you in the right direction. You use the Pop-Tart example. For instance, most vegetables, you don't get any points off for those. So you can eat all the vegetables you like. I think some of the leaner meats, chicken breast, you can eat all, you know, so they really try to steer you away from the triple cream chocolate cake ribeye steaks and steer you over to things with much lower point values or even no point values.
All right. So Weight Watchers, you lost some weight, but then you started gaining it back again. You resigned from Weight Watchers. So after exploring these sort of three main diet genres, the low fat, low carb, just counting calories type diet, then you started like looking, okay, what are people doing in other countries that are known to be relatively thin? What are they doing? And so you looked at something like the Mediterranean diet. I'm sure people have heard of that. And then also the French diet. So let's talk about the Mediterranean diet first. Like, what makes the Mediterranean diet the Mediterranean diet?
The Mediterranean diet is really vegetable forward. I think that's the secret. They use vegetables all the time, often have entire meals that are totally vegetable based. They make that palatable by using tons of olive oil, tons of it. It's you watch a Greek cook preparing, you know, something like a ratatouille type stew, and she'll stand there and literally let oil glug out of the bottle until you think she's playing a trick on you. But the oil makes the vegetables very palatable and gives you enough energy so that you're not starving after you eat it. And then the third key is really abundant use fresh herbs and spices, which satisfies the sort of pleasure centers. So it's no hardship to eat that way at all. You're never hungry, you know, and the irony, of course, is the Mediterranean diet is 40% fat. like an American diet, which, you know, is about 35%. So that's a lot fatter, a lot more fat than our diet, but it's almost no animal fat and all fat from olive oil. So that's the difference. And it was, like I say, a surprisingly satisfying way to eat. I went to a Greek island and spent a week there cooking with a woman, cookbook author I know, and ate like a king, a week's vacation, sort of. It's the first time I've come home from a vacation 3 pounds lighter than when I left. So that's the secret, I think, to the Greek diet. As she said, the Greek diet is a fad that's been going on for at least 2,500 years.
Were you able to keep, you know, sustain it when you got home? Did you try to do the Mediterranean diet when you got back to Vermont?
Well, what I was able to maintain, I took away from that, is have a lot of vegetable, a lot of meals that where the main dish is the vegetables, and satisfy yourself with herbs and olive oil. So I don't say that I live on a Greek diet, but there's sure a lot of that influence in what I eat now because I enjoy it. I say it's no hardship, it's filling. So it's certainly a big component of the way I've eaten now. It's a lesson I learned while in Greece.
Well, and then you explored French cuisine. And I think there's even been books about this. Like, so the French cuisine is known to be very rich, very, you know, tasty, and yet French tend to be not overweight. So how are the French able to like eat this like really rich, delicious food, but not gain weight like Americans?
Yeah. If you look at the facts, it just doesn't seem fair. I mean, these guys, they eat plenty of fat. And it's not all olive oil like the Greeks. They eat great cheeses. They eat, you know, whatever they pretty much want. They don't ever diet. And yet their rates of heart attacks, strokes, and obesity are a fraction of ours. And they're eating all this stuff, from, you know, fried in butter, heavy creams, so on and so forth, and wine, of course. So it didn't seem fair. But I know a French chef in the States here, well-known television chef named Jacques Pepin. And I went to talk to him about it. And he was a good example. Here's a man, he's in his 80s. He eats everything pretty much. He's never been on a diet. He's a professional cook, and he's maybe moderately overweight, but certainly nowhere near obese. And so I sort of took eating lessons from him. You know, how do you do this? And the French employ they're not really tricks because it's ingrained in their culture, but for us it'd be tricks. They take very, very small portions of everything. There's no, you know, 10-ounce rib steak on their plates. They take small portions of everything. They rarely go back for seconds. They almost never snack between meals. And importantly, meals are meals. You don't find the French eating on the run or dashing into a fast food place to grab a hamburger and eat in the car. They view meals and mealtime as kind of sacrosanct. You don't eat at your desk at work. You go out with a group of friends, of colleagues. You sit down at a restaurant and have a meal. So conviviality and community becomes part of eating. You're not just filling your face. You're socializing. French go for quality foods over quantity, which does satisfy your hunger in a better way. You know, you can eat a lot of junk food, a lot of calories of junk food, and still feel hungry. But if you're taking a very high quality French cheese and just have a nibble of it, your senses are satisfied. And so what they do is they put the joy back in eating, which is something that's really missing from almost every diet book I encountered. That, hey, eating is a joyful experience. The table is a sacred place, Jacques said to me. You know, he said, people fall in love over the table. Wars are avoided over a table. It's a whole different attitude toward what food is and what eating means.
Were you able to incorporate some of those, that idea or that sense of food being joyful into your own diet?
I did. I did. I found it very easy to avoid snacking. I used to snack, but it was really just almost unconscious. Didn't give much thought. I mean, I wasn't starving hungry, but I passed by the fridge and grabbed something or stuck my hand in the cupboard and pulled out some peanuts or something like that. So that helped. Keeping, you know, meals sacrificed as much as possible helped. I find it doesn't take a lot of discipline not to go back for seconds. It takes more, just has a little mindfulness, not discipline, not to head back for seconds automatically. To take smaller portions of good food. It's more expensive, but you eat less and you're more satisfied.
So after you did this, you know, world tour and looking, you know, exploring diets here in America, you actually wanted to explore, okay, like what works? Like what, do we have any record of people who have lost weight and have kept it off? Because you said basically it's like 95% of people who go on a diet, they'll lose weight, but they gain it back. But then you uncovered there's actually a scientific registry of people that some researchers keeping track of people who've lost at least 30 pounds and have kept it off for 5.5 years. So tell us about this registry, who's keeping it and what have they found about, you know, what these people who lose weight and keep it off, what are they doing different from all the 95% of Americans who lose weight and gain it back?
Yeah, there is actually such a place and it's got many, many tens of thousands of members, surprisingly. I mean, they're 95% gain it back, but that means there's 5% people out there who somehow figured a way through it. And it's called the National Weight Loss Registry. And professors at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, oversee it. And then, like you said, to make it into the registry, you have to lose 30 pounds and keep them off for a period of years. And there are tens of thousands of people. And so what they've done, I mean, they started the registry back in the 90s because scientists, nutritionists, weren't convinced that it was possible to lose weight and keep it off. So the initial purpose of the registry was, let's see if there are people who've done, anybody out there who's done this. And sure enough, they found several thousand people who did. And then they realized, hey, we've got this group of people who are weight loss, you know, proven weight loss experts. Let's see what they did. Why? How did it succeed for them? And here, the secret, there's no secret. They all lost weight in slightly different ways. Some would go to doctors and lose weight, you know, under clinical supervisions. Most of them did it on their own. Some did it by eliminating certain things from their diet completely. Others cutting back. It just basically, they did everything. That's the message. The one take home is they did it their way. Most of the time, they failed a couple of times, but eventually they found out that to lose weight, you don't follow a diet. You look to yourself and you do it your way. In other words, you start with the way you eat now and see what things in your diet you can cut back on, maybe even quit, whatever works for you, and lose weight successfully. Almost none of them lost weight doing anything extreme, you know, going on nothing but keto or fasting diets or anything like that. They all did it measured and, you know, it was successful. But what was successful for one was not successful for the other. Each had to find their way, sort of the Frank Sinatra approach. They had to do it their way.
Right. And when you do it your way, that's what allows it to be sustainable. Like you're able to keep going for months, years, and able to maintain that instead of doing that one-off diet where, yeah, you lose weight, but then like, I just don't like this, and you stop and you gain the weight back.
Exactly. You know, you may eat too much pizza and you may gain weight from that. But once you recognize, hey, I eat too much pizza. I eat it 3 times a week for lunch at the little restaurant down the street from my office. You can say, well, I love pizza, but I'm going to have to cut that 3 times a week down to 1 a week. Still have my pizza. It can get absurd. They have research subjects at the Brown Medical Center, the Brown University Medical Center. They have research subjects who've lost 50 pounds by shifting from full test beer to light beer. They still got their beer. They must have consumed a lot of beer, but just that one little shift worked for them. Same thing with people who eat too much junk fast food. You know, just cutting back a little bit can work wonders. And so it led me to believe the big problem here is you should not follow a diet. People say, I'm following a diet. That's wrong. That's got the cart before the horse. You should lead a diet. You shouldn't. I mean, no one likes to be told what to eat, right? Nobody.
Nobody, yeah.
It's highly personal how we eat, what we eat. You know, it's right up there with sex. No one, it's just too personal, thank you. I eat in a different way than you. My family eats in a different way than you. I don't want you telling me that you have to have some sort of chopped salad every day for lunch. Sorry, no dice. It's not my style. I don't want you saying you must give up eggs for breakfast. I love eggs. I have a flock of hens. I wouldn't give those up for those eggs up for the world. So if you have someone saying, I've discovered the perfect way to eat, you must follow my template. You can't do that. That doesn't work. What you have to do is lead the diet. Say, well, here's how I eat. I'm the boss. And here's where I might need to make some adjustments that I can sustain and that will help me lose weight. You should start by looking at the, you know, there's three things that I think everyone I talk to would agree with that are kind of big sins. So if you eat a lot of sugar or sugary drinks or sugary snacks, you got to look, you know, that's a good place to cut back. If you eat a lot of highly processed carbohydrates, the white flours, the white breads, the white rice, the you know, grains that aren't whole, if you eat a lot of that, good place to start cutting back. And I hate to break the news, but alcohol might be a good area to look at cutting back on. There's a lot of calories in alcohol, more than you think. And alcohol affects you both your mentally and hormonally in ways that cause you to eat more, you know, so not only do you get the calories from the drink, you eat more on days that you drink. It's again, scientifically validated that people eat much more in addition to the alcohol. So you can look at areas like that and see where there are things that you can, you know, cut back on. You might not go from regular beer to light beer, but maybe when you stop in at the pub, you only have one. Or maybe that bag of potato chips you have every so often is really not necessary. It's got a lot of calories. Do you need that? And you can go through your own diet and find out your own big sins and atone for them. And then what happens is without effort, you start losing weight. Without effort, without willpower, you start losing weight.
So basically just find what works for you. Don't do extremes. Make small changes and basically just do something you like. We've actually had a psychologist on the show to talk about the same thing with exercise. There's no one true exercise you need to do. Basically what she found is find exercise you enjoy doing so that you'll keep doing it for as long as possible. And if that's hiking or walking, fine. If it's CrossFit, great, do that. But just do what works for you so it's sustainable.
Exactly. If you know, like nothing is going to work ever if it's not sustainable. And that's the same thing these people in the weight control registry found out, that if it wasn't sustainable, they didn't lose weight. That simple.
So what have you settled on after all this, you know, 3-year experiment?
Well, my big sin, it turned out, was booze. I mean, I wasn't by any means an extraordinarily heavy drinker. There was always someone who drank more than I and was skinnier than I, which didn't seem fair at all. But I quickly realized that, my two glasses of wine or my couple of beers at the local brew pub added a tremendous amount of calories. And I also realized that, and again, you might not be this way, but I'm one of those people who finds it easier not to take the first drink of a day than not to take the second and the third. You know, it's easy for me to say, forget it and not worry about counting how many shots I've had or measuring out, my cocktails. So I dropped that. And then other things, I had this weird habit of, we have a little deli nearby here and you can get a lunch sandwich there. And a few times a week, I'd go out and do that. And the sandwich came with a bag of chips for the same price. And I looked and those chips were like 400 calories. And I didn't I didn't need that at all. I didn't want it. I didn't need it. I took it. I'd munched them out of habit. So that was one other thing that I was able to drop. I certainly took up what I learned in Greece. And now we have several meals a week where there's not a scrap of meat. You know, thoroughly satisfying meals, vegetarian chilies, ratatouilles, stews of eggplant and things like that, that we learned in Greece. And so I'm eliminating a lot of calories that way, a lot of meat. I certainly try for the very best food I can buy and smaller quantities of that. I go for pastured pork, very expensive, but very tasty. And like I said, one chop will more than satisfy you instead of two. The same with grass-fed beef. I was able to deal with snacking without too much pain. And those are the major changes I made. But I really hasten to add, that's not what's going to work for you. You're going to have to look into your own diet and where you can make changes. I'm very lucky. I have whatever the opposite of a sweet tooth is. But in Weight Watchers, there were a lot of people in my group that just had to wage serious battle with sugar and sugar cravings and all of that. That was their sort of big sin. I have a friend who lives in New York City in a neighborhood that is just blessed with incredible pizza parlors. And he took to grabbing a slice of pizza every day as he went out for lunch. And by giving that up, you know, he lost a tremendous amount of weight and kept it off. You know, another friend of mine simply limits herself to one glass of wine per day, period. And it's worked. So like I say, everybody's going to take a different path. But, you know, if you're mindful and follow some very basic principles, you'll find where you can get the job done once and for all.
And I imagine you've lost some weight since you adopted the Barry Esterbrook plan.
Well, yes, I revisited that same doctor who gave me the kick in the you-know-where to start this off. And my blood pressure had gone into a very healthy level, no, and without medication. So I was off medication that I'd been on since the 1990s. My cholesterol had settled into perfectly normal ranges, gone from too high. And despite the fact that I was a notorious flunker on all these formal diets, I'd lost 26 pounds of the 40 pounds that was my goal. 40 pounds, I will no longer be overweight. As it is, I went from being obese to being not obese at 26 pounds. And, you know, I'm still losing, so I think I'm going to get there. And another important thing is, as my cholesterol and blood pressure shows, you don't have to lose a ton of weight to get a big health benefit. 5% of your body weight, you can see some remarkable health benefits according to the people at the Weight Control Registry. So I've come to the conclusion that I'm never going to be a skinny man. You know, you'd have to repeal some of Mendel's laws of genetics and inheritance to do that. If you look at my family, the men in my family, we all err on the chunky side. So I'll never be skinny, but I think I can be much less heavy and much healthier and much more physically vigorous than I was when I started out on this journey 4 years ago now.
Well, Barry, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
Well, the book is available through all of the, the regular outlets, Amazon, independent stores, any place you normally would buy books, you would be able to obtain a copy there.
Fantastic. Well, Barry Esterbrook, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks an awful lot.
My guest today was Barry Esterbrook. He's the author of the book, Just Eat, One Reporter's Quest for a Weight Loss Regimen That Works. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Make sure to check out our show notes at aom.is/writediet, where you find links to resources where you delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles written over the years about pretty much anything you can think of. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think we get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you to not only listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.